relief factor, pain relief that's natural, pain relief that works, and pain relief that attacks the source of the pain. That's the experience of tens of thousands of Americans who are taking Relief Factor right now. See their incredible video endorsements at ReliefFactor.com and then order your three-week quick starter pack for just $19.95. That's less than a dollar a day. Find out if it can work for you like it works for me by ordering your three-week quick starter pack today. ReliefFactor.com, ReliefFactor.com. Be the next success story. Welcome, dear friends, to this special edition. It's called America First One-on-One, and today we are delighted to have with us, he is a colleague, a mentor, and to millions across California and America, he is a dear, dear friend. They call him the Sage. He is, God willing, the future governor of California, Larry Elder. Welcome to America First.
You know, Sam, if I had a voice like yours, I probably could have made a career in radio. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
As it is, all you do is cram 6 hours of radio into 3 hours, and you're the only guy. Ben Shapiro tries, but he can't do it. You, the Sage, can do it. Okay.
Well, I make up for my lack of resonance in my voice with speed, the trade-off.
All right. First things first, this is the anti-fake news. Okay, this is Salem. We deliver the truth and not spurious allegations and conspiracy theories like the lying mainstream legacy media. And I want to hear it from the horse's mouth. I'm getting conflicting reports. Why Larry did this crazy thing? One of them said, you had enough. You've seen the homelessness every single day. That's what triggered you. Another one of my sources, a very reliable source, said, no. It was Rabbi Prager who convinced the Sage to actually take this brave, brave step. So, Mr. Larry Elder, JD, why are you doing this?
Well, it was a combination of, I would say, 20% a woman you probably don't know named Jenny Sand, who came out of nowhere. She's a political activist here in California, had all sorts of papers, documents, researches, kept contacting me. I was ignoring her. She said, just have dinner with me. So I did, and she laid out the formula for why she thought I could win a statewide election if I ran in this recall election. I thought she was nuts. Then Dennis Prager came to me. So 20% Dennis Prager, he asked me to run, and I said, hell no. 20% a guy named Pastor Jack Hibbs, who has the Calvary Church in Costa Mesa in Orange County, and 20% a man named Lionel Chetwin, who's a longtime filmmaker and friend of mine. So that's, I think we're at 80% now. And then the rest were barbers, laundry people, the guy that drives me every now and then, the one that does makeup for me. I just asked them, do you think I ought to run? People are asking me to do it. And I kept waiting, Sam, for somebody to say, are you insane? You have a great life. You're making some decent money. Why do you want to subject yourself to this? Why do you want to put your personal life to exposure? Why do you want people to twist your life all around and treat you like everything but a child of God? And finally, I got to the point where I said to myself, if not you, who? If not now, when? I'm a native Californian. I've been talking about these issues, about crime, about homelessness, about the outrageous cost of living, about the fact that for the first time in our state's history, young people are leaving the state, going to places like Tennessee and Florida and Texas. And the primary reason is they cannot buy a house. And then you add to that the arrogant way this man shut down the state in the most severe way than any of the other 50 governors, while having his own kids enjoying in-school private education while exempting himself from his own business from the mandate. And this famous French restaurant has become a metaphor for his arrogance, because not only was he violating the mask mandates and the social distancing mandates, Seb, he was with the very professionals who drafted them. And so people would just live it. That's why 2.2 Californians signed petitions to have this man recalled. About a quarter of those who signed the petition are Democrats and independents who just 2 years earlier voted for him.
Tell us the latest developments. If I were Gavin Newsom or his administration, the idea of trying to get you rejected on a technicality is like the dumbest decision ever. Right. You took them to court. You were victorious last week. So tell us what they tried to do to you, where you're at, and how many other candidates there are on this recall ballot.
Well, the Cliff Notes version is this. The outgoing Democrat Governor Jerry Brown vetoed a bill that was passed by the left-wing legislature here in California. And by the way, there are supermajorities in the lower house, the Assembly, and supermajorities in the upper house, the Senate. And they passed this bill. Basically, it was designed to force Donald Trump to turn over his taxes in order for him to qualify for the 2020 ballot here in California. Jerry Brown, the outgoing Democrat governor, vetoed it because he said it was unconstitutional. And said, in California, no bill ever dies. What they do is just lay low and then they reintroduce it. So in comes the current governor, Gavin Newsom. They reintroduce the bill. He signs it. It's litigated all the way up to the California Supreme Court, left wing, 7-0 rules. It's unconstitutional, both U.S. Constitution and state constitution. However, they did rule it applied to gubernatorial races. Now, what it does is require you to turn over 5 years of your tax returns, which I did on time. They require you to turn in two sets, so 150 pages and another copy of 150 pages. For whatever reason, and I acknowledge it was an error on our part, there were 7 pages missing in the second set. Now, they had the 7 pages in the first set, so the Secretary of State could easily have corrected this under statutory power. She has the power to do so. Rather than do that, she kept me off the ballot. So we sued and we made two arguments. A, that the law didn't even apply to recall elections, and if it did, I substantially complied. The left-wing judge, a registered Democrat who went to UC Berkeley for crying out loud, ruled A, that the law didn't apply to Elder, and B, if it did, he substantially complied. So it was gone. They tried their best, and they swung and they missed. And now I'm on the ballot. Okay. Now, there are something like 40-some other Republicans and other people who are on the ballot. Only about a half a dozen are really serious. And already an LA Times poll came out, UC Berkeley poll came out, and I have 18 points. My next challenger has 10 points. I think Caitlyn Jenner has around 3. And I'm not dissing my Republican opponents because it's a two-step, real simple deal. Unless 50% plus one voter rules that Gavin Newsom should be recalled, it doesn't matter what the rest of us have. I'm pretty confident I'm going to finish with a higher vote tally than my other Republican rivals. The question is whether or not enough Californians are going to vote for the recall. And this poll that came out this morning shows 47% are in favor of the recall and 53% are not. That's almost within the margin of error. And that's about a 5-point improvement on our side compared to just 2 weeks ago. People are mad about the crime. They're mad about the mandates. They're mad about the crappy schools that people saw for their first eyes because of the virtual learning that was going on. They're mad about the cost of living. You add it all up, and it's a perfect storm for getting rid of this guy.
And it seems like he's worried. It seems like Nancy Pelosi's nephew, Gruesome Newsom, is worried because every week he's coming up with another plot to buy off voters. Correct, Larry?
That's correct. Even the outgoing governor, Jerry Brown, criticized the spending. And what this governor has just now done is he's given people a whole year rent-free on top of the $300 that you get up until at least September. And this is why California jobs are recovered only to the extent of 50% as opposed to 2/3 in the rest of the country. I have a lot of friends who operate small businesses, who operate restaurants. They cannot find people to work. A group of economists from Bank of America, they weren't Trumpers, all said anybody making about $32,000 a year or less is better off not working than working. And this is what they've done. And again, what Gavin Newsom has done is that he has forced all these businesses to shut. You know, Jeff, you may not know this, but I ran a small business. I practiced law for a while, but I ran a small business for 14 years. It was successful. I sold it, relocated to California. The business kept going. Most businesses that are small fail. Those that succeed are often just payroll to payroll. How many dreams did he kill? How many lives did he dash? You put your hopes and dreams in a business, and they were all gone because of this guy. And people are furious. And I want to remind people there's a direct connection between the crime and the homelessness and the cost of living and this man and the policies that have been pushed by the supermajorities of Democrats in the lower and upper chambers of the legislature here in California.
And tell us about this absurd regulation that there are financial limitations on what you can spend for campaigning, but the incumbent governor doesn't fall under those limitations?
He does not. I have a $9 million expenditure limitation. He can raise and spend an unlimited amount of money. And experts tell me that at minimum, he's going to spend $50 million against me, maybe even $100 million, because I'm the one he's worried about. I'm the one who's from the hood. I'm the one who went to Crenshaw High School, where only 2% of kids can do math at grade level. I'm the one who's representing Hispanic parents who had to go to the ballots to put a petition called Proposition 227 some years ago, Seb, because their kids were in what were called bilingual education, And the idea was that they needed these training wheels in order to transition to English fluency. Well, they weren't transitioning, so Hispanic parents gathered the signatures, put a petition on to get rid of this bilingual education and turn in favor of total immersion. The way, you know, kids came from Italy and from Poland and from Hungary, World War II, they didn't have bilingual education in New York public schools. So the experts said these kids are not going to be able to learn. And surprise, surprise, after the proposition passed overwhelmingly, several years later, guess what? The kids were transitioning to English fluency far faster than they were before. And some of these so-called bilingual experts had enough integrity to publicly say, we were wrong. These are the people that Democrats, the majority of black and brown ones, want choice in school, and they pull the lever for Democrats that betray them year after year after year. And I go to the hood, and I go to the barrios, and I'm telling people, these people are betraying you. And the beauty of a secret ballot is you could put your check next to Larry Elder, even though he has an R next to his name, and you don't have to tell your independent friends. You don't have to tell your Democrat friends. Aren't you tired of the crime? Aren't you tired of the homelessness? Aren't you tired of the cost of living? They don't have colors. They don't have ideologies. It's affecting every, well, I shouldn't say everybody, because rich people don't give a damn, even though we have the highest state tax in the country, 13.3%, and poor people are taken care of by government. It's middle-class people who are leaving for the very first time. It's a war on the middle and the working class by the very people who you put into power year after year after year. They are betraying you, and I can make that case in ways that scare Gavin Newsom.
And it always has been thus. Support this man. He's got my vote. ElectElder.com. ElectElder.com. Okay, so let's step back a moment. This is America First. We're talking to my Salem colleague. He's running for the governorship of the great state of California, which I used to call it the People's Republic of California. But thanks to Jennifer Horn and lots of Californians I met in California, I decided we don't make fun of it, we don't give up on it, and he definitely hasn't. So, and hopefully when he becomes the governor, he'll hire Jennifer Horn to be his press spokesperson, because she needs to
Done.
Be... Good.
Done.
Good, because she's a champion.
That's a bet.
We love
that's
Jennifer.
A bet.
Okay.
Done.
So for those who, for some reason... stumbled upon this podcast, stumbled upon this clip on Rumble or wherever, and they've been living under a rock for the last 40 years and they don't know who Larry is. Tell us a little bit of where you came from, how you got to be this incredibly successful media personality, radio show host, and also, if I may, please, I've heard it four times before, it makes me cry every time, tell us your story, your seminal story of reconciliation with your father.
Well, my dad came to California in 1945, right after the war. He was a Pullman porter on the trains. They were the largest private employer of blacks in those days, Seb. And this black boy from Athens, Georgia, came out to California and was astonished. You could walk in the front door of a restaurant and literally get served. So he made a mental note that maybe someday I'll relocate to Los Angeles. Pearl Harbor, my dad joins the Marines. I once asked him why the Marines, and he said two reasons. They go where the action is, and I love those uniforms. So my dad is stationed on the island of Guam, where he is a staff sergeant in charge of cooking for the colored soldiers. Goes back to Chattanooga after the war, where he met and married my mom, to get him a job as a short order cook. And pardon my language, Seb, he goes to restaurant to restaurant to restaurant to get him a job as a short order cook. And they tell him they don't hire niggers. My dad goes to an unemployment office. And the lady says, you went to the wrong door. My dad goes to the door that says colored only, to the very same lady who sent him out. My dad went home to my mom and said, this is BS. I'm going to California, where I had been before the war, and get me a job as a short order cook in Los Angeles. They'll hire me. So he goes to restaurant to restaurant to restaurant out in California, in LA, and they tell him he doesn't have any references. And my dad says, I need references to make omelets? So he goes to an unemployment office, this time just one door. He sits in the chair for a day and a half, until the lady calls him up and says, I have something for you. I don't know whether or not you're going to want to do it. And he said, sure, I'm going to want to do it. What is it? And she said, it's a job cleaning toilets with Nabisco brand bread. He did that for 10 years, took a second job with another bread company for 10 years, cooked for a family on the weekend to get additional money, and went to night school a couple of nights a week to get his GED.
Larry,
the man,
Larry, in all of that time, did he ever say or intimate that he was a victim?
Never. And that's my point. My dad saved his nickels and dimes with these kinds of jobs and bought a house, which is still in the family, in an area of South Central Los Angeles that we thought was uptown. I mean, we were the second black family in what was then an all-white neighborhood. And right now, that house is valued at $600,000. You couldn't buy a house like that with an eighth grade dropout education if you worked three jobs. And the point is, the cost of living in California has gotten so outrageous that you cannot possibly pursue my dad's path. Now, my dad and I had a rocky relationship because he was always yelling and screaming, and I thought he whipped us too hard and too often. And when he started the little cafe, I had to work for the SOB. So now I'm 10 years old. I'm working for him for 5 years. He's yelling and screaming at me, in my opinion, unnecessarily. This is a little diner. Don't think of a restaurant. Think of a little diner where everybody can hear everything going on. So now I'm 15 years old. I got tired of the way he spoke to me. And I said to myself, next time he yells at me, I'm going to walk out. I wish I could tell you, Seb, I said to myself, the next time he yells at me, I'm going to sit him down and I'm going to say, see here, from now on, you and I are going to have a different relationship. But I was afraid of my father. So I walk out. My dad came home. He was furious. He paid me $10 a day plus tips. He balled up the $10. He threw it at me as I lay on the bed. He walked out of my bedroom and after asking me, why did I leave? And I said, I got sick and tired of the way you spoke to me, Dad. We did not have a conversation, Seb, for the next 10 years. And when I say not conversation, I mean not even do you think it's going to rain? How about those Dodgers? I mean nothing. And he was easy to avoid because he worked long hours. I graduate from high school. I go to college on the East Coast. I go to law school in the Midwest. I end up working in the Midwest for several years. And I would come home to visit my mom. I would just make sure my father was never around. We did not speak to each other for 10 years. Now I've graduated from law school. I passed the California and Ohio bars. I'm working for a major law firm in Cleveland. Right now I'm making the equivalent of probably about $175,000. And I'm 25, 26 years old. And I should be living large, but I can't sleep. I'm having nightmares. I'm thinking about my father. Not that I ever thought we'd be friends. But I called my secretary and I said, cancel all my appointments. I'm going to L.A. I didn't tell my parents.
What were you thinking? Like you have unfinished business or what were these thoughts?
It was unfinished business that maybe I should just tell him he's an SOB. Maybe he'll tell me I'm an ungrateful son. And then the air will be cleared sufficiently so I can sleep at night. I didn't think we'd ever be friends. So I come out to California without telling him. I walk into the restaurant at 1:30. I knew they closed at 2:30. My dad was shocked to see me. I had a big bag with me. He said, should I put your bag in the back? I said, no, Dad. I'm only going to be here for 5 or 10 minutes. I want to tell you something. He said, okay, wait until we close. I sat at the counter for an hour, and I said to myself, now, Larry, don't tee off on the SOB. Don't tell him everything he's ever done to you. Just give him the highlights, and he'll probably call you an ungrateful son. Maybe you'll be able to sleep. So the man sat next to me, not more than a foot or two away, and I promptly teed off on him. Told him everything he ever did to me, the spanking that he gave me one time when my cousin Elaine was watching and laughing, all the times he hit me, all the times he hit me with a telephone cord, all the times I thought he was excessively angry and mean. And I spoke for 20 minutes, Seb. And after 20 minutes, I was out of ammo. I couldn't think of anything else to say. And my father looked up and said, is that it? You didn't speak to me for 10 years because of that? And for the first time, I saw my father cry. Now, my father's a big man. I didn't think he had the ability to cry. He cried, and he said, let me tell you about my father. You know your last name, Elder? I said, yes. He said, that's not the name of my biological father. Now, keep in mind, I knew my dad was an only child because we never got any Christmas presents, and I knew he had no father because we didn't get any Christmas presents. Outside of that, I didn't know a damn thing about my dad's life because I didn't care. I didn't like him. I didn't care. And my dad, for the next 8 hours, told me about his life. Elder was the name of the man who was in his mom's life the longest. She was irresponsible, didn't work, could neither read nor write, had a series of boyfriends, each one crueler and dumber than the one before. Elder was an alcoholic who physically beat his mom, and when my dad intervened every now and then, he beat him. My dad was punished severely. The reason my dad used a belt, Seb, is he thought that was a progressive way of punishing kids. He was smacked with anything, a fist, a rock, any damn thing. My father thought he was being genteel when he was spanking us. And my dad told me about his life. And as he told me about his life over the course of the next 8 hours, as we sat at these two stools, he got bigger and bigger and bigger. And Larry got smaller and smaller and smaller. And now I'm crying. And I said to my father, please forgive me for judging you so harshly. And he said, there's nothing to forgive. You just didn't know. Follow the lessons I've always told you and your brothers. Hard work wins. You get out of life what you put into it. Larry, you cannot control the outcome, but you are 100% in control of the effort. And before you moan and groan about what somebody else did to you, go to the nearest mirror, look at it, and say, what could I have done to change the outcome? And finally, he said, no matter how good you are, how hard you work, sooner or later, bad things are going to happen. How you respond to those bad things will tell your mother and me if we raised a man. Now, I wrote a book about this eight-hour conversation called Dear Father, Dear Son, Two Lives, 8 Hours, because after we had the conversation, I go back to Cleveland, and my father wrote me a letter. He never wrote me a letter. And it said, Dear Son. He never called me son. And I wrote him back and I called him Dear Father. Now, my father was a lifelong Republican, Seb. He believed Democrats want to give you something for nothing. And when you try and get something for nothing, you almost always end up getting nothing for something. He disliked Democrats. He never would allow us to think of ourselves as victims. He always told us the door is wide open. Go through it. Work hard. You can do whatever you want to do in America. It is yours to take. And that's the philosophy I've always lived under. And that's what I think has made my brothers and me so successful.
You've got to read this book. I've heard the story several times now. It always gets better and better. Dear Father, Dear Son. And it tells you the opposite of what we're hearing from the left. You need not be a victim, especially based upon your skin color. We are talking to Larry Elder. He's running for the governorship of California. Follow him at Larry Elder. He has a very good... His Twitter game's not bad, but his Instagram game is even better. We're talking about his background, how he got to be where he is today. Talk to us, firstly... Let me run this past you, okay? This is a big picture idea that I just heard this weekend at a wedding where I spent most of the wedding talking to a black conservative who's been involved in politics a long time, but he's also a very successful businessman. And he understands what I do. His wife works for one of the big conservative think tanks. And he said, and it wasn't confrontational, he was just trying to give his point of view. Guys, you've got to cool it on the critical race theory. Conservatives have got to cool it on the culture stuff, because especially when you're trying to connect with black America, with minority America, they don't want to hear that stuff. It immediately labels you as a conservative. They shut down. But they can be engaged with when you ask them, hey, how hard is it for you to get a permit to open your barber shop? What is the business environment like? What is the taxation like in downtown Chicago? And he says, you can get to the important culture stuff like fatherless families, but if you come in there talking about it, you're never going to have that conversation. It kind of opened my eyes, because for me, culture, 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 Andrew Breitbart, you know, Alex Marlowe, your young intern many moons ago.
Right.
But is this guy right that engage with the people who should be conservatives, whose values are conservative, but who vote Democrat through the lens of business and economics? I'd love to hear your response, Larry.
Well, let me put it this way. In my 37 years in radio and TV, 27 years on radio, I've invited Al Sharpton on my show probably a 50 to 100 times, Jesse Jackson the same number, Farrakhan the same number. But one of these so-called black leaders, a term I'm not particularly fond of, did come on my program. His name is Kwesi Mfume. At the time, he was the president of the NAACP, former member of Congress from Maryland. Now he's back, by the way, in Congress from Maryland. And I said to him, right, my first question was verbatim this. Mr. Mfume, as between the presence of white racism or the absence of black fathers, which poses a bigger threat to the black community, end of quote. And without missing a beat, the man said the absence of black fathers. Now, 70% of black kids enter the world today without a father married to the mother. That is up from 25% back in 1965. Unless you're prepared to say America is more racist now than it was in 1965, you have to conclude that that has nothing whatever to do with race. A nouveau liberal named Lyndon Baines Johnson launched a so-called war on poverty and basically allowed women to marry the government and allowed men to abandon their financial and moral responsibility. And now we have this problem. But these are the people supposedly who are on your side who have destroyed the nuclear intact family. Same thing with education. 75% of black boys here in California, Seb, cannot read at state levels of proficiency, and that's a low bar. My former high school, Crenshaw High School, the one that was featured in Boys in the Hood, only 2% of kids can do math at grade level. Now, there are 300,000 public school teachers in California. It is estimated that a minimum of 5% are utterly incompetent, should be fired. That's 15,000 teachers running through the halls of our classrooms, undereducating, miseducating, or not educating our kids. You wouldn't put up with that with the LAPD. The LAPD is 10,000 persons strong. Imagine if 5% of them were corrupt, planting evidence, using excessive force, racially profiling. We wouldn't put up with it. But we're putting up with 15,000 public school teachers who are bad. And many of them end in the inner city, not in the valley, not in the west side where parents complain. And recently there's been a study that shows 2/3 of black families in the Los Angeles Unified School District do not want to send their kids back to school after the school opens up in the fall. Two-thirds. And they blame systemic racism. Now, before you roll your eyes and go, okay, another allegation of systemic racism, because most of the teachers there are black, many of the administrators are black, the principals are black. What they mean is the worst teachers end up in the inner city, the black and brown schools where good teachers are needed the most. Now, who's on your side? I want the money to follow the child. The $12,000 per capita, actually I think it's higher than that, that we're spending per student should follow the child, and the parents should be able to use that money in a private school, a charter school, a religious school, or a public school. The teachers union adamantly opposed to that. And you look at where they send their own school-age kids. In Philadelphia, 44% of public school teachers who have school-age kids send their own kids to private school, as opposed to 10% of families nationwide and 6% of black families nationwide. 39% in Chicago, LAUSD, Los Angeles Unified School District, where I am, public school teachers with school-age kids are twice as likely to put their own kids in private schools compared to families that don't have a public school teacher. And I've often said this is if you opened up a restaurant, put up a sign and said, come on in, just don't eat the food. Now, these are Democrats that are in parents. The polls show majority of them want vouchers. These are Democrats who are not giving them to them. You're being betrayed. And I can make the case in ways that other Republicans cannot or have not, because I'm black. I'm from the inner city. I've seen the deterioration of the quality of schools with my own eyes. Now, out of the 300,000 public school teachers, I mentioned that 5% of them are incompetent. That's 15,000. Guess how many are fired any given year? 2.2.
Wow.
Honestly, it's outrageous. And Gavin Newsom shutting down the schools, the kids are already behind, as I mentioned. His own kids enjoyed private in-person school learning, and he exempted his own restaurant from the very mandates that he's crammed down the throats of everybody else. He's a hypocrite. He's anti-science. He didn't give a damn about the rising crime, about the rising homelessness, about the outrageous cost of living. There's a magazine called CEO Magazine. It's been in existence for exactly 17 years. And based on taxes, spending, the degree to which the business climate is friendly or unfriendly, the unfunded pension mandates, the strength of the public sector unions, they have determined that for 17 consecutive years, California is the worst state of all 50 in which to do business. This is why, for the first time, young people are leaving.
Incredible, incredible. All right, let's pull out. We'll talk about California. Support this man, electelder.com. Let's pull up. Let's go to 50,000 feet. Let's talk about the last 2-3 years in America, Larry. BLM. Let's talk about our response to BLM as conservatives. What is... So there's this big issue on the right for the conservative movement. Do we ignore the accusations of racism and just say, no, it's about freedom, independence, small government, the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, and engage like that? Or does there have to be some recognition of racism? We don't buy into the white supremacy garbage mantra, but can we engage? Can a white conservative like me, Larry, engage with my fellow Americans in the inner cities as a conservative and American? I need an answer from somebody who's been delivering the truth and has all the facts at his fingertips. How do we solve this problem in an era where social justice is the mantra for one side of the argument?
Tell the truth. Malcolm X once said, I'm for the truth no matter who's telling it. I've often said this, pick up your magic wand, wave it over America, remove every smidgen of racism from the hearts of white America. Now every white person thinks like Mother Teresa. Do we still have 70% of black boys entering the world without a father married to the mother? Do we still have a 50% dropout rate in many of our urban high schools and where kids who do graduate cannot read, write, and compute at grade level? Are 25% of black boys in many of our urban settings having criminal records, having been arrested on parole or on probation? Is the number one cause of preventable death for young white boys accidents like car accidents? Is the number one cause of preventable death for young black boys homicide, almost always at the hands of another black boy? Is a young black man 8 times more likely to be killed than a young white boy? If the answer to that series of questions is yes, then I submit to you systemic racism is not the problem, and critical race theory and reparations are not the answer.
Okay, let's talk about the language of how we engage. You are, I truly, I've watched you because we've been in the same location when you're prepping for a show. I've seen the amount of work you put in, and truly, it is a data dump in the best sense of the word. You give enough debating material in 30 minutes. You do more than any other host I know. But here's my challenge to you. One of the reasons that the Gipper was so successful is he melded two things. He'd spent more than a decade traveling from GE factory to the GE factory, being paid to lecture the American worker on why capitalism is the best, why Republican democracy is the best. So Reagan had all the facts at his fingertips, but having been a Hollywood star, he could also communicate. He had that emotional intelligence that he wasn't just putting up a pie chart or a Laffer curve diagram, but he could talk to you and he could talk about a new morning in America. He could engage the heart of the listener whilst he also had the truth and the facts behind him. In recent years, especially with the Ben Shapiro, facts don't care about your feelings mantra, I think we're falling back into that trap where the left lies, but they do it with such an emotional alacrity, social justice and everything else, that it gains traction. We far too often say, oh, look, here's another policy paper on, if you lower the taxes, you'll have more revenue. And we think that's enough. Is the conservative movement in an age of MAGA, in an age of America First, have we forgotten how to meld the two together, Larry?
Well, I think you're being too hard on yourself. I love your show. I love the way you communicate with people. I'm serious.
I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about, of us.
But everybody's different. And you're right about Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was able to give facts and also tell stories. And I give facts and I tell stories, too. So to that extent, I guess there's some similarity there. But again, I think it's just about telling the truth. Why is it that a white person would be reluctant to tell a black person the truth? Are you telling me a white coach can't coach a black athlete or vice versa? It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Should there only be black teachers of math and science? Ridiculous. Tell the truth. And it's up to other people, including black people, to be willing to receive the truth. Stop thinking of yourself as a victim. Stop acting as if only a black person can relate to you. That's a bunch of horse bleep. One of my favorite heroes growing up was Sandy Koufax, and he was a Jew. And I remember during the World Series, he refused to pitch during Yom Kippur. I didn't know what Yom Kippur was. I went to my mom and I said, how can somebody not pitch in the World Series? And she explained to me what Yom Kippur was, and I had even more respect for him because of his class and character. By the way, if I may, fast forward several years later, and I'm able to meet Sandy Koufax. I've always wanted to be a writer more than anything else. And the first thing I ever wrote, I was in the sixth grade and it got published. It was a poem about Sandy Koufax. And the first stanza is, Koufax is on the mound. The game has just begun. He gets a sign from the catcher and swish, strike one. So fast forward 20 or 30 years later, I'm at an event, black tie event. And Sandy Koufax is in the front table, and I'm in the nosebleed seats, but I know a publicist named Warren Cowan who knows everybody. And I said, any way you can get me down to that table to meet Sandy? And he says, wait a second, I'll go find out. He goes to come back in 5 minutes and says, follow me. We go up to Sandy Koufax, and he introduces Koufax to me and tells him I'm a writer and I'm a talk show host. And I said, Sandy, I told him the story I told you. I said, Sandy, the first thing I ever wrote was a poem about you. Can I give you the first stanza? He goes, go ahead. I said, Koufax is on the mound. The game has just begun. He gets a sign from the catcher and swish, strike one. He puts his hand on my shoulder. He says, don't quit your day job.
That's excellent. Follow him at Larry Elder. Support him at electelder.com. We need to save America, but let's start with California and let's get him into that governor's mansion. Okay, let me tell you a story, okay? Thank you for your kind words. We need to tell stories. Help me to explain why this happened. So Candace Owens has talked very eloquently about the new political plantation. It's not cotton picking, but it's still Democrats, and it's a political plantation with dependency on the state. I was in San Francisco not too long ago. Some firefighters recognized me in a coffee shop, and they invited me to their station house. Amazing guys. I mean, they are in the Tenderloin, in the worst part of San Francisco. Awful stuff. And half of them were Democrats. But they all had had enough with California. So why is it, whether it's the black voting majority or whether it's, good guys risking their lives every single day have had enough with the Democrat Party, why is it these communities still vote for them, Larry?
That's a good question. And by the way, my good friend Thomas Sowell, the economist, once talked about how much blacks and whites had in common. And by that, he meant this. We often talk about the housing disparity, the net worth disparity. But he said, look at the bottom half of blacks and the bottom half of whites in terms of net worth. The advantage to whites is just 3.5%. The real gap is that the top 10% of white families, top 10% of black families, top 10% of white families make way more money than the top 10% of black families. But the bottom half of whites versus the bottom half of blacks, almost the same. And so the crap that the elites pull that hurt people at the bottom, whether it's critical race theory, whether it's demonizing the police, so they pull back and bad guys know it and the people being hurt are predominantly black and brown people, whether it's the elite people like Rob Reiner, who years ago stopped a housing project called Amundsen Ranch. It would have built 9,000 homes. I admit the land was pristine and beautiful, but there are always trade-offs, unless he lives on a houseboat. Wherever he lived at one time was pristine as well. But he stopped it. 10 years later, they high-fived each other. I read an article about it. Not a single person said, well, now there are 9,000 people who didn't have homes. That's the reason the price of housing is so high in California, 150% more than the average home outside of America, and 50% of the price of housing in California has to do with environmental regulations, all of which are pushed by people living in the who belong to the ACLU and the Sierra Club, who want to develop pristine land while they're sitting in homes that at one time were pristine. It's the people at the bottom who are hurt, blacks and browns and whites, all of whom have a great deal in common. I can make that case. I can make that case. I am making that case. And that's what they're afraid of. They're afraid I'm going to be able to talk to voters, Democrats and independents, in ways that other Republicans never have and for some reason don't think they can.
Okay, so let's talk about this latest decision of yours. We're talking to Larry Elder. This is America First. He is the sage from South Central. Listen to him every day to get 6 hours of radio in the space of just three. Talk to us about, we know why you took this decision. It is absolutely understandable. Talk to us about what your plan is for California and how you can make it happen despite the Democrat supermajorities.
Well, one of the reasons I didn't want to run, Seb, is because of the supermajorities that you talked about. And I figured that once I vetoed something stupid, it would be overridden fairly easily. Well, I found out that there hasn't been a bill overridden since the early 70s. And that was the first time that Jerry Brown was governor. It turns out that Arnold Schwarzenegger, who wasn't really a Republican, wasn't really a conservative, vetoed hundreds of bills. Not a single one was overridden. Now, what happens is you veto something stupid, you go to the public and tell them how stupid the bill was, and believe it or not, the phone rings if you're a senator, the phone rings if you're an assembly person, and your constituents are mad that you almost passed this stupid bill. So you have that ability. You also have the line item veto. You also have the ability to declare a statewide emergency. And I talked with the in-house counsel for a former governor named Pete Wilson. And I said, how come you can't use a statewide emergency on housing? He said, what do you mean? I said, the housing developers tell me there are 500,000 units all ready to go if only the lawsuits would stop. Why can't I declare a public emergency and get rid of that environmental law called CEQA, California Environmental Quality Act, that has been used to basically hold up almost any construction project? He said, I never thought about it. I said, how come I can't use my statewide emergency power and declare a public education emergency and fire the 5% of public school teachers that are incompetent? He said, I never thought about that. How come I can't use my statewide emergency power and declare a public emergency on homelessness to do a couple of things? Repeal Proposition 47 that allows you to steal up to $950, not every day, every store. And if you get caught, you get a ticket, you get a misdemeanor. Well, the idea behind it was interesting and valid. People like that are often stealing to support a drug habit. They ought to go to treatment rather than to jail. The problem is, once you remove the threat of them going to jail as felons, there's no incentive for them to go to treatment. So people are stealing to support their meth habit. And when the cops try to do something about it, they say, or else what? And what they want to do is to build houses for the homeless at costs substantially higher than what the private sector could do if it weren't for these Environmental Quality Act. I would declare a statewide emergency and suspend CEQA. And by the way, CEQA was waived for the Sacramento Kings Stadium up in Sacramento for a billionaire that wanted to build it. So they can certainly get around CEQA when they want to, but when they don't want to, they're hurting middle class and working class people, as I mentioned. So there are at least three things I can do: declaring a public emergency in education, public emergency for homelessness, public emergency for the cost of living, and even for crime. Crime is up dramatically in Bay Area, in LA, in San Diego, for a couple of reasons, not least of which is that the police are engaging in this defund the police movement. Now, Barbara Boxer, the former senator from California, just got mugged yesterday. Her cell phone was taken, for crying out loud. And a few days earlier, the chief of police of Oakland, happened to be black, was complaining about all the money being moved out of the Oakland Police Department for these ridiculous programs. I'm in Los Angeles. $150 million moved out of the LAPD budget. Crime are up. Homicides are up. Shootings up year to year. What the hell is going on here? And once again, the people who are hurt are primarily people living in the inner city, black and brown people that march in there and pull that lever for the Democratic Party. You are being betrayed, and I can make the case in a strong way, and that's why they're so afraid of me, and they should be.
They definitely should be afraid of Larry Elder. Support him. Go to electelder.com right now. Larry, let's close on another big picture question. In the last year and a half, as I've been enjoying hosting my radio show, it's come to me that we only really have one issue, one real problem in America. It doesn't matter what your personal issue that most impassions you is, whether it's the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, the right to life, lower taxation. It matters not what the primary issue for you personally is. The biggest problem we face as a republic is a general, and I mean a pandemic level, lack of courage in this nation. I look at the response to COVID, the response to the lockdowns. I look at the response to we knew they were going to steal the election. We knew that there was going to be fraud. So I ask you, Larry, do you concur that we have a lack of courage? Clearly, you've taken a very courageous step right now. Or where do you see the largest deficits in what should be the greatest, shiniest city on the hill?
Well, thank you for the compliment. But when I'm talking about courage, I'm not storming the beaches of Normandy. I've never served in the military. These are people that put their life on the line. So I appreciate what you said. But I was just talking this with a buddy of mine the other day, Seb. I'm going to get your reaction to this. If somebody had told me before the coronavirus pandemic, there's going to be a pandemic. It's going to kill about 500,000 Americans. That's less, by the way, than Americans that were killed in the Spanish flu around the World War I. And government is going to shut down the entire economy of this country, the entire economies of the state of California. I would have said at least 30, 40, 50% of the people would have said, F you, I'm going to continue going to work. I'm going to continue going to school. Throw me in jail. There'd be so many people in jail, they wouldn't be able to enforce the law. There was a restaurant owner out here who kept his restaurant open despite the threats to cite him. He was cited over and over again, still kept it open. They put chains on his restaurant. He cut the chains. They cut his power. He put in the generator. Finally, they hooked his license to sell liquor, and he finally shut out the business. I would have thought there would have been hundreds of thousands of Americans doing just what that guy did, and they wouldn't have been able to get away with this. I am shocked how many Americans, like sheep, like lemmings, did what they were told. It blows me away, just as I was blown away by Obamacare. No one could have told me that the government could force every man, woman, and child, whether they could afford it, whether they wanted it, or whether it was effective, to get health care by government mandate. I'm shocked at the willingness of people to be told what to do by government. I really am. I want to know what your reaction is.
As a person who had a father who risked everything, was arrested, tortured by the secret police, then liberated from a communist prison cell. You know, for me, I had that example of courage before my eyes from the moment I could understand it. As somebody who chose this nation to become its citizen, to move my family here because I truly believe it is the greatest nation on God's earth, I'm truly horrified. I mean, I am utterly horrified. Absolutely. The idea that people just didn't have, you know, if Gandhi could do it against, mm-hmm. you know, the British Empire, that we actually managed to declare our independence from with just civil disobedience, then why couldn't we do it here in America? The idea that the businesses are just gone, you know, decades worth of investment for families, and they've just disappeared. I'm as disgusted as you are. So I guess you agree with me that the virtue we lack the most is courage.
And I remember you saying, Seb, early on in this thing, you said, I refuse to wear a mask. I remember you saying it distinctively. You said it over and over. And just yesterday, Jerry Brown is now ordering state workers to be tested once a week.
Newsom.
I'm sorry. Yeah, who did I say?
Brown.
Okay, so yeah, Brown. Not a whole lot of difference. But yeah, you're right. He just now said, if you are a state worker and you haven't been vaccinated, you're going to be tested once a week and you're going to wear a mask at work. Now, think about this. We're told the reason for being vaccinated is that you're protected against people who've not been vaccinated. So who are you protecting yourself against by wearing a face mask when you've already assumed the risk of contracting the coronavirus? The other people who've not been vaccinated at work have assumed the risk. So why are you telling people who've assumed the risk to protect other people who've assumed the risk when you're telling vaccinated people that the reason to get vaccinated is that you're protected? The whole thing is anti-science. It doesn't make any sense. And once again, the state workers, like lemmings, are going to do what they're told. I am amazed. I'm amazed at this.
Yeah. So, and just one codicil to that. It's not just the grown-ups. The thing that horrifies me the most is what we're doing and have done to our children. The children, healthy children, who have a mortality rate of 0.05 from COVID are still being masked is unconscionable. Okay, let's end on your mission to get California back. It's electelder.com. What is your final message for all Californians or those outside California who want to support you, Larry?
My final message is, as California goes, so will go a number of states. People tell me that people leave California and they blame their left-wing policies with them. That's because they haven't connected the dots. So if you want me to, when Californians leave, for them to not pull the lever for the Democrats, they should at least be educated as to why they're leaving. And if you love the state of California like I do, even as a tourist, help me make the state great again. There's a magazine called The Atlantic, left-wing, came out a few months ago. The California Dream is dying. This is a left-wing magazine saying this. So help me by going to electelder.com. Again, as Sebastian and I were talking about, Gavin Newsom can raise and spend as much money as he wants. The estimation is he'll spend anywhere from between $50 and $100 million to defeat me. I cannot win without your helping me. And for the millionaires and billionaires that Bernie Sanders talks about, you can send your money to political action committees that support choice in school, that support the repeal of that proposition called 47. Because if I don't have a war chest that rival his, I cannot beat this man.
The governor, Gruesome Newsom, is very worried. And that's reason enough to support this man. God bless you. We are praying for you, Larry. If anybody can do it, you can do it. He's the author of Dear Father, Dear Son. He's my colleague. I consider him a friend and a mentor. He is the sage from South Central. Support him at electelder.com. God bless you, Larry.
God bless you, Seb. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.